with a prayer by our chaplain, followed by the Pledge of Allegiance to our flag.
From the 22nd chapter of Matthew, we hear, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. You shall love your neighbor as yourself." God of love, help us to express our love to those who mean so much to us, especially on this Valentine's Day. Help us to express our love and care to those whom you have given to us, and show in small ways how our heart sings a song in their presence. And may we be neighborly to those we meet daily, especially those who want nothing from us but to be our friends and a help to us. In your holy name we pray. Amen.
Amen. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Nice sweater. Secretary, call the roll.
Senators Brown, Callahan, Chappelle Nadal, Crowell, Cunningham, Curls, Dempsey, Dixon, Engler, Goodman, Green, Justice, Kevany, Kehoe, Kraus, Lager, Lamping, Lemke, Mayer, McKenna, Munslinger, Nieves, Parson, Pierce, Ferguson, Richard, Ridgway, Roop, Schaaf, Schaefer, Schmidt, Stouffer, Lawson, Wright-Jones.
Senator from St. Francois. Senator from the 9th. A quorum is present. The Senate is in session. Secretary, read the journal.
Journal of the Senate, second regular.
Senator from 23rd.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move further reading of the journal be dispensed with and the same be approved as though having been fully read.
The motion of the Senator, as many as are of the opinion as shall prevail, say aye. Those to the contrary, no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. Reading is dispensed with. Introduction of guests. And the Senator from Johnson, as usual, is on his feet with his hand in the air, shouting.
Thank you.
Proceed, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. President. I have three very peculiar guests today. And you guessed it, the mayor of Peculiar is Ernie Youngmeyer. Mayor, if you'd raise your hand. Also an alderman for Peculiar, Holly Stark. And Brad Ratliff is the city administrator. So let's welcome our guests from Peculiar.
I'm not sure the senator's supposed to do that. On your order of business, introduction of guests. Senator from Boone.
Thank you, Mr. President. On my right and your left, we've got the Mizzou Women's Soccer Club. With them today is Diane Dahlman, the director of Mizzou Rec Services, Melissa Operly, the club sport coordinator, and Laura Salerno, the assistant director of Rec Services. And the team won the Women's Open Championships at the 18th Annual National Campus Championship Series National Soccer Championships. It's a great accomplishment for them. They're a wonderful group of young women, and we've got a resolution to acknowledge their accomplishments, and I'd ask the body make them feel welcome.
The body, please make the guests of the Senator from Boone welcome. Thank you. Congratulations. Senator from Newton.
Mr. President, today I'm introducing some special guests from Seneca High School. These young fellows would raise their hand. Marion Wilkes, Josh Souter, Chance Smith, Jack Reed, Josh Griner, and Coach Doug Osborne. And they're again from Seneca High School, and they're here because they were winners in the Life Smart National Online Competition. I would ask the body to make them feel welcome.
The body, please make the guests of the Senator from Newton feel welcome. Introduction of guests. Petitions, memorials, remonstrances, resolutions, concurrent resolutions. Senator from Johnson.
I have a concurrent resolution.
Please send your concurrent resolution forward. Madam Secretary, please read the resolution. What? Don't want to read it. Would you like to explain your, and it will be printed in the journal?
Yes, I would. Thank you very much, Mr. President. I think all of us realize the importance of energy independence that we have in our country and how we as Americans and Missourians must do all that we can to protect the environment and to be energy friendly. This Senate concurrent resolution, basically, which is signed by about 11 of my colleagues, talks about the importance of the Keystone XL project, and it's to encourage our federal delegation to support this and support ways that we can be more energy independent.
Thank you, Senator. It will be printed in the journal. Do we ask for, is that it? On the order of business of concurrent resolutions. Introduction of bills. Senator from the 4th.
Mr. President, I have a bill.
Send your bill forward. Madam Secretary, please read the bill.
Senate Bill 788, introduced by Senator Keveney, an act relating to the appointment of circuit clerks.
Senator, would you like to explain?
Mr. President, this bill would make the circuit clerk in the 22nd Judicial District a appointed position. Thank you.
Introduction of bill. Senator from the 8th. Send your bill forward. Madam Secretary, please read the bill.
Senate Bill 789, introduced by Senator Krause, an act relating to DNA profiling.
No explanation.
Introduction of bill. Senator from Cape.
Thank you, Mr. President. I've got a bill.
Send your bill forward.
Thanks, sir.
Madam Secretary, please read the bill.
Senate Bill 790, introduced by Senator Crowell, an act relating to a moratorium on the redemption of certain tax credits.
Senator, would you like to explain?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. President. This legislation would put a moratorium on redemptions of tax credits. As many of my colleagues know, and as Missourians all across this land know, well, if we are to go with the governor's proposed budget, we're looking at a third year of massive cuts to higher education. We're looking at, to put it kindly, K through 12 foundation formula funding basically remaining level, and massive reductions to programs such as parents as teachers, programs for transportation funding of school buses in outstate Missouri. And we are looking once again at double-digit growth in the redemption of tax credits in the state of Missouri. Here's a statistic for people. This year, our consensus revenue estimate and our Senate appropriation staff has estimated that we will redeem almost $700 million in tax credits. That's 10% of the available GR that the senator from Boone as the appropriations chair has to deal with within our $23 billion budget. 10% goes outside of the appropriations process and continues to grow at double-digit rates. This legislation puts those tax credits on the table as we right-size government to existing revenues. It makes no sense to me that we consistently allow tax credits to grow at double-digit alarming rates while reductions at other state services continue to be plagued. And I'm going to share with you something that you may not know. Missouri has only grown at 1.3% in revenues through this January. All right? That is well below the 2.75 that we predicted that we would grow in the consensus revenue estimate. What is the practical ramification of all of that? We're already between $90 and $100 million short. And we're running around here as if everything's hunky-dory. We have to now, to be able to realize the general revenue that we are budgeting upon, what the House is budgeting upon, and what the Senate is budgeting upon, we have to realize at least 5.3% growth this next fiscal year. Folks, we're not going to grow at 5.3%. It's not going to happen. It's not even going to happen that we'll grow at the 3.9% that they called the growth back in November, December when we reached the consensus revenue estimate. We have a problem, Houston. We have a problem, Houston. And it needs to be addressed. And it needs to be addressed with leadership within the Senate, where everything is on the table as we have a discussion of how we're going to right-size state government to existing revenues. And this is one more effort to try to carry on that dialogue. Thank you, Mr. President.
Introduction, Senator from the 8th. What purpose do you seek recognition?
Inquire, Senator from Cape.
Senator from Cape, you yield.
I yield.
He yields, Senator. You may proceed.
Senator, I got a little bit of what you were talking about in your bill. I want to ask you a real quick question. Maybe you know the answer, and if you don't, I do. What do you think our current liabilities are with tax credits right now? Liabilities.
Which
mean
one?
All of them.
I mean, I know that the largest one that has extending liabilities, which is the low-income housing, because it streams for 10 years, and I've said it often on this Senate floor, to look at our contingent liabilities within unfunded liabilities within the low-income housing tax credit, it's just a grid, 10 by 10, so you go to square 100, and it has a number of in excess of $1.3 billion.
The numbers that we have are $998 million that tax credit alone.
On grid 100.
Right.
Okay. Then you must have better updated numbers than
this. This is stuff that they presented to the Appropriations Committee this year. I took all of
Who's
them.
Who's they?
You have two different groups that present tax credits. You have Ag and then you have DED. So DED presented this one because it's in DED's
low-income housing?
Yes. There's yeah. I mean, those are the two people that run the tax credit programs. Yeah. And so they have a book, and I've got it in my office if you'd like to see it. But $998 million is what is on there. The overall liability for all tax credits, over $2 billion. That's how much money that has already been issued and awarded. All it has to happen is they have to claim it.
To redeem it.
They have to come in and actually say, here, instead of me paying my taxes, instead of me giving the state this revenue, they only have to say, here's my tax credit.
They give them a coupon.
And they don't pay it.
Yeah.
I'll give you
one even better, Senator. Sometimes it's not even pay my taxes. It's cut me a check. So, you know, these are what are called refundable tax credits, the vast majority of them, historic and low income, where you don't even have to have a state tax liability. You just give them this coupon and we'll cut you a check back.
I thought your number on how much we were going to spend on tax credits this year, I've heard 675, you said 700 today.
Almost 700 million, which is 10% of available GR. It's $700 billion,
you know, what's
7 billion.
What's an interesting comparison, and what I'm trying to start to make a comparison, you know what our higher appropriation
Below $1 billion now.
No, what we're
higher education,
we're expecting to spend just over $700 million with the governor's proposed cut. Just over $700 million. My prediction, not this budget year that we're doing this year, but next year when we come to the General Assembly, if we don't change tax credits, my prediction is tax credits will exceed the amount of money we're going to appropriate for higher education.
Absolutely.
So that says everything in our budget is impacted by this fleecing of Missouri tax dollars.
Without
everything. With higher ed, elementary, secondary education. I mean, we really need to get this under control.
Yeah,
I commend you for bringing this bill forward.
Well, and I appreciate that. We've got a lot of our colleagues in the House that continue to want to pass tax credit after tax credit after tax credit. Folks, you can't cash flow that anymore. You know, even if you want to take their assumed job growth, it doesn't happen till year 10. DED right now is standing around saying MAMTech's going to create jobs. On DED's books, they still say the Moberly MAMTech fiasco is going to create jobs. All right? How much suspension of reality and belief do you have to convince yourself of to buy into this foolishness that giving special interests these tax credits is some gonna way be the panacea of all panaceas. You know, the senator from Andrew, Nottoway, whatever, wherever his mobile home has brought him in a given time period, has articulated this very, very well. And that is, I've seen him many times. He'll hold up a quarter and he'll go, "Who'll give me a dollar for it? It's a quarter. Who'll give me a dollar?" Well, folks, as taxpayers, you do that deal every day as it relates to historic preservation tax credits. Then you hold up a dime and a penny and you say, 11 cents, folks, who'll give me a dollar for it? Folks, we do it every day with the taxpayer dollars on low-income housing. We get 25 cents on return to be generous on historic preservation over 10 years. You know, that's a loss of 75 cents. And we get 11 cents net return on low-income housing over 10 years. And we continue to convince ourselves around here, because of the special interests associated with it, that somehow this is a great deal. It's not. And the House wants to pass a bill to not fully fund the foundation formula. Well, why don't they just not? I mean, I just don't get it that we have certain parts of our community that think the be-all, end-all is how well they rehab an old building when they have failed miserably at educating a child and providing that youth with an opportunity in this world. But what do? They hold up and say, "Look at this old post office we did. Ain't that grand?" Now, I'd like to see you graduate a child. You know, relatively speaking, if we want to talk about success and what I will pin a gold star on your lapel for, how about you get your graduation rates up and keep your old buildings secondary to all of that?
I'm with you. I think this body as a whole, we've passed out tax cut reform.
Yeah, it's a challenge with the House. Definitely.
And the governor has now come on board and has said he's in favor of tax credit reform this year in his state.
Yeah, but you know, the governor said that in his state of the state, and it didn't even require him to draw a breath. Now, I'm for tax credit reform, and then he moved on to a gazillion other things.
I understand that, but I'm just making the point that we have one hurdle left, one major hurdle, and it's the House, and hopefully they can come and join us this year reforming tax credits so we can get the priorities back in this state.
And I hope you'll be here with many of your other colleagues that we've raised this as an issue and be able to champion it forward in future years.
Well, thank you very much for your
thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Senator, I'm going to recognize the senator from Lewis. I think he has some guests that might be.
Yeah, Mr. President, I have like a unanimous consent to introduce some very special guests we have in the chamber with us today.
Hearing no objection, Senator, proceed.
Thank you, Mr. President. It's an annual event here in the Capitol where we welcome some great people from around the state, and they're our future leaders. These are the FFA students. They're sitting up in the upper gallery. And like I say, FFA, I think, is one of the best organizations that we have in the state as far as providing leadership. And, of course, I'll remind everybody again that agriculture is the largest industry we have in the state. And these are our future leaders, and help that along. There's two very special people I would like to introduce that are with the group today. And one is the president of the state FFA, and that's Brady James. He's from Herdland, which is in my district. And Corey Hudson from Middletown, who is a state vice president, also from my district. And I'd sure like the body to make them feel welcome.
Would the guests of the senator from Lewis please stand and the body make them feel welcome. Senator from the first.
Thank you, Mr. President. Could I inquire the senator from the 8th?
Senator from the 8th, do you yield?
I do.
He yields, sir. You may proceed.
Thank you, Senator, for yielding. I appreciate your comments and conversation with the senator from CAPE. It reminded me of the comments that we had last week between myself and the senator from Buchanan in the idea that why do you think that an issue as big as the idea that our tax credit programs have grown now to an estimated $700 million of revenue not coming into the state to address and help address important priorities as education, K through 12, higher education, all the different things, you know, that we have to address, that the media doesn't report on that. As they don't report on the mismanagement or fiscal irresponsibility in the Medicaid program, where we're trying to look at how are we being good stewards of the people's resources.
You know, maybe we're just not making enough emphasis on this floor and this body on the fact that the tax credits are stealing money from our education. The yep. fact that we've held education flat over the last few years and that double digits, as the senator from Cape mentioned, double digits we've increased the amount of money on tax credits in the state of Missouri. And to me, that shows that we don't have our priorities straight. And I know this body has passed tax credit reform legislation out at least twice, one last session and one in special session. So I think it's, you know, we are doing what we need to do to try to reform this. But it, obviously we got a little hurdle, like I mentioned earlier, over there in the House, and hopefully they can come on board. And I think it's important that they do. I don't understand why the press, maybe it's because it's a complex issue. Maybe it's not as easy as drawing a line from A to B. You've got to connect the dots there a little
right.
bit.
Well, I would contend that one of the reasons that they don't report it is because we've been talking about a structural hole in this budget for a number of years. But that hole has been filled with borrowed money from China and the federal government continuing to bail the states out. We've talked about it on the Senate floor going through the budget process the last couple of years, but we decided to kick that can down the road. And it was easy for the media to ignore a real problem that we have with Missouri's budget, okay? And nobody wants to address it. Nobody wants to address it, you know, either by reform. Nobody wants to address it with, you know, raising taxes, okay? They just want to say, they just want to kick the can down the road. Well, yourself, many of our colleagues have said, have embraced reform when it comes to tax credits, okay? But I believe they haven't printed it because we really haven't seen real pain. The only place that we've seen real pain is in higher ed, and you mentioned that. You know, we're at what funding levels now? Back to 1997 funding levels?
After this year. This year's budget gets approved now.
I remember the high mark when I was serving in the House. The higher ed got just over $1 billion from the state, right? And mm-hmm. now it's just, you mentioned earlier, just over $700 million.
That's what's projected for this year's budget now. The governor did find through some another $40 million, and he's proposing that we put that into higher ed, which is I commend him for doing that, because I think that the $100 million plus that he was planning on cutting was too much, and
right.
I'm glad we were able to, through a lawsuit, come up with $40 million. But you know what? We're only plugging it for another year.
Right.
We're taking one-time money and putting it on ongoing budget items. So if revenue doesn't come back and tax credits continue to grow, something's going to have to be done the following budget year. And that's going to be even, you know, where are we going to go then? Are we going back to
where the general revenue is, right? And unless we fix this problem and have the reforms that we need so that this $700 million isn't taken off the table as far as its ability to meet our needs and priorities of the state,
mm-hmm.
I believe that you know, maybe the media at that point would say, well, the reason that the General Assembly can't fund these things is because, you know, they have no choice. The revenue is not there, so they have to go somewhere, okay? And I really believe that this body has been serious about those reforms, and pressure needs to be put on the other side of the equation, the House, to get these reforms that we need.
And you've seen my one cheater so far.
$2 billion.
$2 billion liability. That's going to have to be paid. That money's not, I mean, already been basically issued
right.
and given away. We have that liability. It's not getting any better. Next year,
it's going to keep going up.
It's going to keep going up unless we have some reforms.
Right.
And it impacts every part of our budget. If anybody in the state is listening, you get money from the budget. Tax credits are impacting the amount of money that you are going to get in the future.
Right. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you,
Mr. President.
On the order of business, introduction of bills. Senator from the Ninth.
Thank you, Mr. President. I request unanimous consent of the Senate to withdraw Senate Bill number 787, as I had previously filed this legislation.
Hearing no objection, it will be withdrawn.
Thank you. And Senator, I have a bill, Mr. President, if I may.
Your bill forward. Madam Secretary, please read the bill.
Senate Bill 791, introduced by Senator Curls, an act relating to small loans.
Senator, would you like to explain the bill?
No explanation.
Thank you. Senator from Lewis.
Yes, Mr. President. Unanimous consent to introduce some more very special guests.
Hearing no objection, Senator, proceed.
Thank you, Mr. President. In the upper gallery back here in the middle is a group from Northeast Missouri who hosted Fall in Love with Northeast Missouri last night. I want to thank all the senators that did attend, and we're trying to keep up with the rest of the state. We're latecomers, but it was a great event last night and look forward to growing that next year. The group we have with us today and last night, of course, is business and industry leaders, tourism people, and also local governments. And I'd like the body to make them feel welcome.
Body, please make the guests of the Senator from Lewis feel welcome. On the order of business of introduction of bills. Introduction of bills. Senator from the 23rd.
Thank you, Mr. President. Would you see if there are messages from the House? If there are, would you please have those read?
There are messages in the House. Madam Secretary, please read the messages.
Mr. President, I'm instructed by the House of Representatives to inform the Senate that the House has taken up and passed House Committee Substitute for House Concurrent Resolution 3, a concurrent resolution relating to submission of a proposed federal balance budget amendment to the United States Constitution. Also, the House has taken up and adopted House Concurrent Resolution 13, in which the concurrence of the Senate is respectfully requested. Respectfully, Daniel Adam Crumless, Chief Clerk.
Senator from the 23rd.
Thank you, Mr. President. Without objection, the Senate will go to the order of business of reports of standing committees.
Order of business is reports of standing committees. Senator from the 23rd.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your Committee on Rules, Joint Rules, Resolutions, and Ethics has a report.
Please send a report forward. Madam Secretary, please read the report.
Mr. President, your Committee on Rules, Joint Rules, Resolutions, and Ethics, to which was referred Senate Bill 611, begs leave to report that it has examined the same and finds that the bill has been truly perfected and that the printed copies furnished the senators are correct. Also, Senate Bill 594 begs leave to report it has examined the same and finds that the bill has been truly perfected and that the printed copies furnished the senators are correct. Also, Senate Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 485 begs leave to report it has examined the same and finds that the bill has been truly perfected and that the printed copies furnished the senators are correct. Also, Senate Substitute for Senate Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 469 begs leave to report it has examined the same and finds that the bill has been truly perfected and that the printed copies furnished the senators are correct. Respectfully, Senator Dempsey, Chairman.
Senator?
Thank you, Mr. President. Without objection, the Senate will go to the order of business of Senate bills for perfection, the informal calendar, Senate Bill 591.
Senate bills for perfection, informal calendar, Senate Bill 591. Senator from Polk.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move that Senate Bill 591 with the committee substitute be called from the informal calendar and taken up for perfection.
You've heard the motion of the Senator from Polk. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. Senator from Polk.
Mr. President, I now move that Senate Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 591 be adopted.
Go ahead.
Mr. President.
You go ahead and explain your bill.
Senate Bill 591, basically, some years ago, for the assessors across the state of Missouri, it was put in the statutes that the NADA, or the National Automobile Dealers Association, was the only publication that the assessors could use across the state of Missouri. How that come about, I don't know, but it seems odd to start off. We'd put a company in there establishing that they are the only ones that would have that value for the county assessors. Over the years, what's happened, originally when they started buying these publications and the software, this became a $3,000 cost to most of the to all the county assessors across the state. Well, that fee keeps increasing and increasing, and now it's up to close to $50,000 it costs the assessors in the state of Missouri, and it's the only one in the game. Nobody else can compete. So what this bill would do, it would allow the state tax commission to go select, or give them the ability to go out and look for other publications that are similar to the NADA or whichever their approval was, and then allow the county assessors to use that guideline to be able to do the assessed personal property values across the state.
The senator from Polk has moved for the adoption of the Senate Committee substitute for Senate Bill 591. Does any senator wish to speak on that motion? Senator from the 23rd.
I have an amendment.
Please send your amendment forward. Has it been distributed?
It has not. I ask that it be, it is short, and I ask that it be read.
Madam Secretary, please read the amendment.
It's 591.
Senate Amendment 1, offered by Senator Dempsey to amend Senate Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 591, page 5, section 137.115, line 129, by striking the following, quote, value guide, close quote, and inserting in lieu thereof the following, quote, single, close quote.
Senator, would you like to explain your amendment?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. President. I would move for the adoption of the amendment, and as an explanation, you know, don't have any problems with the change that the senator from Polk wants to make. My interest with this amendment would be that basically we give the state tax commission the ability to choose a publication. I just want to make sure from a uniformity standpoint that every assessor, that they choose one publication and that every assessor uses that same publication. And I believe that this clarifies the language in the bill.
Senator from the 23rd has moved for the adoption of Senate Amendment Number 1. Does any senator wish to speak on that motion? Senator from Clay, what purpose do you seek recognition?
Mr. President, to inquire the senator from the 23rd.
Senator from 23rd, do you yield?
I do.
I yield, Senator. You may proceed.
Senator, while we're talking about this, if somebody could bring me a copy of your amendment, I would sure appreciate it. Or if you could just show it to me. Thank you.
You go to page 5. You look at line 129, deleting value guide and inserting in lieu thereof the word single.
Any single publication used for establishing the value of motor vehicles is approved by the state tax commission. Senator, thank you, and I think that does clarify it. I have some legislation that I filed with regard to this, which has just been brought to me. And my concern is this, that our assessors are always pressured by tax recipients to keep the assessments high, which always puts the taxpayer at a disadvantage. And one of the things that I had done in my legislation was said that the assessor could choose, but in the process of choosing, that they had to choose the national publication that overall was the lower valuation, because my concern is that they're always going to be pushed to take it to the higher valuation. So I was wondering if you would be amenable to either a substitute amendment or an amendment to the amendment, or maybe we don't even have to do that. Maybe we can work something out in here so that the presumption is in favor of the taxpayer, that when the tax commission establishes whatever these rules are going to be, which sooner or later is going to come in front of the Joint Committee on Administrative Rules, I'm sure, which may come back before this body, that there's a presumption that they have to pick the one that they believe is the overall lower in valuation as opposed to maybe the one that would be higher.
You know, I understand what you're saying as a taxpayer, someone who has vehicles.
Yep.
Certainly, that's what the direction I'd like the state tax commission to have. You may want to visit with the senator from Polk, as it's his base legislation. I just wanted to make sure with my amendment that they're all using the same standard.
And I see what you're getting at, and it's probably better than the legislation that I'd filed, because mine actually gives the discretion to the assessor to determine which that they're going to use, but whichever they use out of all the guides that would be available to them, they'd have to use the lowest valuation.
Yeah, I want your assessor and my assessor to be using the same publication.
Gotcha. Well, let me inquire of the senator from Polk then, if that be the case. Mr. President.
Senator Clay.
May I inquire of the senator from Polk?
Senator Polk, do you yield?
I do.
He yields, Senator. You may proceed.
Senator, you are not a high tax person, are you?
Pardon me?
We need to keep the voices down so we can hear. Head senators.
I said, Senator, you are not a high tax person, are you?
No, I'm not.
All right. Well, Senator, the deal is here, your bill and the Senator from the 23rd Amendment would leave it up to the State Tax Commission as to which guide that they would choose. I just believe that in the best interest of the taxpayer, that there should be a presumption and a directive from this legislature that the Tax Commission needs to choose the national guide that overall has the lower valuation of your property as opposed to them picking and choosing whichever one has the higher valuation. And would you be amenable to a friendly amendment that gives some direction to the Tax Commission that, hey, folks, we don't want you out there picking and choosing whatever is going to cost the taxpayers more money. Rather, we want the presumption to be in favor of the taxpayer. We want you picking and choosing the national guide that overall is going to have the lower valuation placed on those for assessment purposes.
Yep. Thank you, Senator. But I guess what I'm saying, what I was trying to do is give the Tax Commission the ability to do what you're saying. If they could select four or five nationally published, or whoever they decided had a reputable reputation in that industry, then you would have the process, maybe a county assessor would, to use one of those four or five. Now, if you go to the one, which the Senator from 23rd is saying, I don't know which one that is that would be picked. What the Senator's trying to do, which is make the assessment equal all across the state, in that. But you would also go through the process of just selecting one company again for a time period. I guess my thought process is maybe they would be somewhat of a little bit of a, whether it be a bid project or that there would be alternative choices to just one. And I would assume the Tax Commission would probably look at some recognized assessments or car dealer books across the United States, which there's plenty of them out there and there's plenty of them online, to come up with that. And unless you really got, I think, way off in left field in some automobile dealer assessment of the vehicles, most of them nationally pretty well have the same market. If you go online and see what cars are across the country, you can about look, whether it be the East Coast, Midwest, West Coast, through auctions or whatever reasons you want to go. And that's pretty readily available online now.
I'm not exactly sure what you just said because I'm having a hard time hearing you. And it doesn't have anything to do with noise in the chamber. It just has something to do with the sound system. But I think what you said is they're all the same or close to the same. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Ask me that again.
I think what you said is all the valuation publications, whether it's NADA or the Kelley Blue Book or whatever, right, that they're all pretty close to the same. Is that what you said? Okay. My assessor doesn't think so. My assessor sent a letter out to every taxpayer in the state of, or I'm sorry, in the state of Clay, in the county of Clay, every taxpayer in the county of Clay, and said, well, the legislature has mandated that I use a certain guide, and it's higher. So if your taxes are higher, it's because the legislature picked it. And so now all we're doing is delegating to the Tax Commission without a directive to the Tax Commission that, oh, by the way, it's the intent of the legislature that you have, that you choose whichever publication, the single publication, if the Senator from the 23rd Amendment goes on, that would be the overall lower in valuation. And that way, our assessor back home in Clay County or any other assessor across the state that decides to do it will no longer be sending out to the taxpayers that we in the legislature have chosen a publication that's higher and costing them more money. I think we need to actually put in here that there's a presumption that they will pick the publication that overall has the lower valuation. Okay.
What
I'm going to do, because our assessor believes that there are certain publications out there that are higher in value and has told all the taxpayers in my county that as we turn this over to the Tax Commission, if that's what this body decides to do, that the Tax Commission is directed to determine which has the overall lower values for the average passenger vehicle, and use that publication so that we're putting a presumption in there of the lower assessed valuation as opposed to the higher?
I guess my first answer to that would be is if you took, say you took the lower, then you have to figure out, can you hear me okay now? Is that better?
I don't know. I'm trying to get the microphone closer to my mouth so that
if you took the lower bid, let's say, or the lower, depending on what that was. So, for example, okay, you've got clean, extra clean, rough, in all these books, in all these assessed evaluations. I mean, you have different degrees of what a vehicle's values worth, you know, and then you have whatever that middle range is, and I assume. I'm trying to think, is that a good thing for us to tie the hands to anybody to do that? And if you pick, let's just say you picked a lower assessment that wasn't right, do the counties or do the municipalities or the schools, do they make that difference up? And I don't know that. But, I mean, well, they're always saying you have to change the levy to make that up.
It sounds to me that this Senate has to decide whose side they're on. Are we on the side of the taxpayer, who then is going to have the burden of proof of coming in and saying, no, my assessment ought to be lower? Are we going to be on the side of government that has in its best interest to keep their assessments high and take more money out of the taxpayer's pocket?
Right.
I think we need to make a policy decision that we are going to be on the side of the taxpayer. Let the burden be on the government if they think it ought to be higher. Let them bear the burden. They're the ones that have all the taxpayer-supplied lawyers. They're the ones that have all the staff. Whereas the little guys that are in your district and my district, the farmers and the truckers and different people like that, it just, I mean, the working moms, you come in and they say, oh, you've got a, you know, I don't know, a 1974 Maverick and it's worth $20,000. I don't think so.
Yeah. Right.
So, although the senator from the 13th says that he's got one of those, it's probably in pristine condition. It probably has shag carpeting in the back, which would increase its value.
Well, Senator, do you feel like if you give the tax commission that choice,
no,
that takes care of a little bit of your problem?
The tax commission needs to be given a directive that they will take the average, they will choose the guide that is the lower in value for the average passenger vehicle. That's going to gather probably 90% of all of our taxpayers, that they have to look at the average passenger vehicle and say that we're choosing the lower. And at least we give the taxpayers a leg up in this whole process. Right now, let's face it, the entire assessment process is lined up against the taxpayer and for government that receives taxes. Well, and that's not right.
I think we both agree. Whatever's the least we do to the taxpayers, that's what I want to do. I'm not trying to make that burden on them. I'm just trying to think the thing through. Would we be in the same scenario where we picked another company? I mean, would you then have the, I want to say, I guess a little bit of a bidding war or everybody trying to do a lesser amount so they get to be that?
I didn't hear you.
Well, I mean, at some point you have to make sure it is even if you took a low evaluation, it has to be a decent evaluation. You see what I'm saying? In other words, if you know that...
No, it sounds like to me that what you're saying is that you want it to be fair. Okay, I'm with you. We want it to be fair.
Right.
And we would agree that all of these national guides would be fair. Is that something we can agree upon? Okay.
Assuming
so we started out that we wanted it to be fair. We agree on that. We secondly agreed that all these national publications would be fair. And we've also agreed that apparently some of these national publications come in a little lower or a little higher. And it sounds like that we also agree that we want the presumption to be in favor of the taxpayer.
Right.
So that means that if the tax commission has a choice between taking NADA that says my 2004 truck is worth $15,000,
right,
as opposed to Kelley Blue Book that says my 2004 truck is worth $16,500, that they would have to overall look at those passenger-type vehicles and say, hey, overall, Kelley Blue Book is lower, so this year we're telling the assessors they need to use Kelley Blue Book. And if next year the Black Book or whatever, NADA, comes in overall lower, leave that up to the tax commission to decide how the... actually, one of the things that I would like to do is for the good folks over there, Mr. Ertl, that's sitting at the table, I would like for them to draw up an amendment for me that adds a sentence that in determining which single publication that establishes the value of motor vehicles
that the State Tax Commission shall evaluate and use the guide, recommend the guide that overall has the lower value for passenger vehicles in the guide. And it could be a separate sentence or however they decide to do it. I'm going to support the senator from the 23rd Amendment. I think he's right that it needs to be a single publication used for establishing the value of the motor vehicles. But I also agree that we, as guardians of the taxpayers, because, Senator, you know, there's hardly ever anybody in the hallways that says, hey, you know, I'm out here representing working mom. I'm out here representing small business owner. I'm out here representing Joe Blow Farmer. There may be some large organizations in some instances, but we're the guardians of the taxpayers. That's our job. Mm-hmm. And I just believe that we really need to give a directive in the rulemaking process that the Tax Commission needs to choose that publication that overall has the lower value for the average passenger vehicle, and I think we'll be okay on that. And again, this comes from a real-world example from my assessor in a first-class county. We've got probably, I don't know, 240,000 people in my county, somewhere in that neighborhood. And she sent out a notice that indicated that we, as a legislature, had chosen the higher book value. And I don't ever want us, as a legislature, to be accused of that, because I think we stand on the side of the taxpayers.
Right.
So Senator, I appreciate what you're doing, and I am going to be offering an amendment, so I'll either kind of stand up and spin my wheels until the amendment is prepared.
That's
or
fine.
We'll
That's
see
fine.
If there's other debate on it. And I appreciate you bringing this bill forward.
Okay. What the intent of what I was trying to do by making it where there was three or four, of course, not to say that your assessor couldn't go out there and pick the highest level. You know, politically back home, kind of my area, that's not very smart of them to do that, but I understand what you're saying. But if you had the spread where, and say it's not too much or whatever it is, you would have the choice. That assessor would be able to go out there and say, okay, I'm going to use this guide for Polk County. Or I suppose if they wanted to, they could use whichever end. But I guess you give that back to the local level to say, okay, you decide what you want to do to your people back home. That was the purpose of why there was more than one selection.
Oh, I see. So are you saying then that you would be in opposition to the senator from the 21st Amendment?
Let's take our conversations outside or to the rear so the senators can hear each other.
Senator, are you saying that you would prefer that the Tax Commission not choose a single guide that applies to the entire state of Missouri and let the local assessors choose whichever one that they believe that's a nationally recognized guide?
Whichever one of those four or five they come up with, or what they come up with, then the assessors would be able to use whichever one of those guides that was there.
And, Senator, that's the way that the bill that I wrote was originally written, so that our local assessors, who are accountable to the taxpayers, could make that determination. So let's say in your district they've got a lot of, I don't know, let's say they've got a lot of agricultural vehicles
sure. mm-hmm.
that need to be valued, and
right.
they know that the NADA is very close to Kelley Blue Book on passenger vehicles, but overall on ag that is lower. That's the way my bill was written, that the local county assessor could choose. But once they chose, they had to stick with that particular guide, so that they don't use Kelley Blue Book for you, and then your neighbor, they use NADA. And if they did, I was just going to put a directive in there that they had to choose the one that had the lower valuation, that they couldn't always be picking the one with the higher valuation. Because, once again, I wanted the burden to be on the government to prove higher as opposed to on the taxpayer to prove lower. But, Senator, what I don't know, because I would prefer your position rather than having a statewide standard, one size fits all, I don't know if that's constitutional.
To be able to have one that the evaluation is the same across the state, is that what you're saying?
Or no,
just the option?
Your option that I would choose. In retrospect, my concern is if St. Charles County uses Kelley Blue Book
Right.
And Polk County chooses NADA. What I don't know, and I'm kind of looking over there, is can we authorize the county assessors in effect to pick one, so conceivably we could have, you know, a patchwork all across the state. I think the senator from the 23rd is trying to draw it into uniformity. The tax commission says NADA is the guide, then NADA is the guide for Clay, St. Charles, and Polk.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm not a tax expert, Senator, but I guess the one common sense side, I mean, we do that every day as far as taxes back home in cities, whether you pay more taxes in the city, whether you pay more school taxes. Through that process, I think you do that all the time on a local level, but I don't know if that's the same as what we're talking about here.
Senator, you and I may have to just have a conversation when we are a little closer, because up until this year, I didn't have any trouble hearing, and now when you're talking to me, I'm really, really trying to hear you.
Okay.
And I'm having a hard time. So I can't tell if what you're saying is that you prefer to leave it to a situation where every county assessor would be able to choose from among several nationally recognized guides. Is that what you want?
Whatever the tax commission would approve. Those guides are.
For
that, statewide. They would have to stay within that arena.
Okay, so the tax commission would choose, they would say NADA, Kelley Blue Book, Black, whatever, they're all approved guides, and then out of those approved guides, then the assessor of the county would have to choose one.
Correct.
Okay. So you couldn't choose NADA for tractors and then choose Kelley Blue Book for passenger vehicles?
No, I don't believe that to be the case.
Okay. And what the senator from the 23rd would be doing would be saying that the tax commission would have to pick one for the entire state, not an approved list of maybe four.
Correct.
Okay, so you would rather leave it so that the tax commission could choose an approved list of four?
That's correct. That's what my bill is.
Okay. And at that point, we really need my amendment to say that the assessor then would have to choose the lower.
Well, if you go with your amendment, my understanding would be then the center from the 23rd would be fine too, because you're only asking for one and you're asking for the lowest one.
Okay. Okay. Upon able counsel here, I've been informed that if we go with what you're talking about, that it could be interpreted to violate the uniformity provision of the Constitution if you have multiple guides, each county choosing a different guide. However, let's see, and my amendment would have to be a substitute amendment. Is that right? Senator, I know that there's some other senators, or I think that there's some other senators that want to talk about this, so I'm going to visit with legislative research while we sort this thing out.
Okay.
And what I draft may have to be a substitute amendment for the senator from the 23rd.
If you go with one, then you went with the lower one, then the senator from the 23rd's amendment, I believe what you're trying to do, you're just going to say he wants one and it'd be the lowest one.
Yeah, the debate right now is whether or not the state tax commission is going to choose one guide that would be recommended for any given tax year, as opposed to you want the state tax commission to approve maybe up to four. So that's one issue. And then my issue is to make sure that either the tax commission or the county assessor, if the amendment from the 23rd does not go on, and the tax commission chooses four approved guides, then my amendment is going to be that the assessor needs to, from those guides, choose the lowest valuation. If his amendment does not go on, then I'm...
Because,
going to, or it does go on, then I'm going to say that the tax commission has to choose the one that for passenger vehicles has the overall lower value. And, okay, well, I'm going to talk with Senate Research here,
okay,
and then you can deal with some of these other folks that have some questions.
All right.
Thank you for the inquiry, and thank you for getting the microphone closer to your mouth.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator from the 21st was the first one I saw seeking recognition. 24th, what did I say?
I'd like to inquire of the Senator from Polk.
Senator from Polk, you yield. Senator from 24th. He yields. Senator, you may proceed. Senator from the 8th.
Seeking unanimous consent to introduce a special guest.
Hearing no objection.
All right, I have two constituents, Jeff and Wanda Quibel, that are over here to my left and your right. Jeff is a city councilman in Blue Springs, Missouri. If the body would make them feel welcome, I would appreciate it.
The guests, please stand, and the body make them feel welcome. Proceed, Senators.
Mr. President, seeing how we're kind of in the time-killing mode right now, I'd just like to take the opportunity to make the point to the Senate, to this body, the ridiculous nature by which we tax ourselves, the whole idea of this personal property tax as associated with taxing our motorized vehicles, is an incredibly inefficient way.
Are you inquiring of the Senator from Polk?
I am.
Okay.
So speak to this. And so, Senator, I would just suggest that what your bill is doing is it making it blatantly so very obvious how incredibly inefficient this is as a form of taxation to tax our motor vehicles as the, you know, after the point of sale and as they're owned over time, and to have to go into all these different iterations and different methodologies of assessment. And I know your bill is not, your bill is to operate in a system in which we operate today, which is to refine it and make it better. I just wanted to take the opportunity to point out the fact this is a ridiculous way for this state to create tax revenues. And hopefully in future sessions, we come up with another way in which to tax ourselves. So thank you for the inquiry.
Senator from Franklin, what purpose do you seek recognition?
Thank you, Mr. President. May I inquire of the Senator from Polk?
Senator from Polk, do you yield?
I do.
He yields. Senator, you may proceed.
Senator, I just want you to know that the basic premise of what you're doing here, I'm with you. I'm with you all the way, okay? But I do think there are some things that need to be tweaked about this, and so far it seems like I think you're going to be somewhat friendly to some of the ideas that have been brought up. I did want to say concerning your immediate past inquiry, I just want to say, yeah, what he said, okay, because I agree with that. So let me just make sure that I understand what's happening right now. If we don't change anything, if your bill dies and everything just stays exactly the same as it is right now, currently the NADA, it's mandated that they use NADA to do these evaluations?
Correct.
Okay. I'm just going to tell you, as a guy who grew up in the car business, okay?
I understand that.
And I hope none of my other car dealer friends get mad at me when I say this. But, you know, sometimes we buy on one book and sell on another.
I'm well aware of that.
Okay. And so I am acutely aware of the fact that these books do vary in their evaluations, okay? And I think you're being a bit gracious to the industry when you say there's slight differences.
Okay.
Because my good friend, good senator, there is more than a slight difference in these books, okay? And so as it stands right now, where the NADA is the mandated book that has to be used, I don't think that's a good system, okay? You know, I think, and you may have heard me say things like this before, but, you know, I think it's kind of absurd in America, right, that we go and buy something, we pay for it, and we pay some ridiculous amount of tax at the point of purchase, right? And then our government, I mean, this is, if it wasn't so sad, it would be funny that our government then comes through what I call legal plunder and extracts money from us, much in the same way that the old mafia movies that you would see. You remember those old mafia movies where the mafia you know, boss would send one of his lieutenants, somebody would open up a new business on such and such street, and they would send one of their lieutenants down there to say, hey,
You never know what might happen here. You know, this place could catch on fire, right? And they'd say, but for $200 a week, we'll make sure that everything is okay for you. You know what they call it? Oh, you were a sheriff, weren't you? What do they call that in the sheriff world? When somebody comes and says to you, you know, I'm afraid some really bad things are going to happen to you unless you pay me $200 a week, and then I can assure you those bad things won't happen. What would you all call that in the sheriff world?
I think that would be considered blackmail.
Blackmail, extortion, things like that, right?
Yeah.
In government, we call it legal plunder. We call it the government coming to us and saying, oh, you bought that car 5 years ago? You paid taxes on it 5 years ago? Now what you're going to have to do is you're going to have to pay us for the privilege of owning something that you own. And you know, that's a whole different discussion for a whole different day, okay? But I think what you're doing here, I think your underlying bill that we're in the process of trying to mess up for you, I think it's a good bill. Because I think as a person who grew up in the business and is acutely and intimately familiar with these books that we're talking about, you know, I like to use the NADA book when I sell. I don't necessarily like to use the NADA book when I buy.
You like the banks to use the NADA book. You like to use the black book to purchase the car.
Exactly. When I send one of my customers to the bank to get financing, I want them to use the NADA when they calculate loan value, okay?
Right.
So I think if you'll work with us here, I think if we have, whether it's both the amendment from the junior senator from St. Charles along with the amendment of the senator from Clay or a hybrid of the two or whatever, I think that what they're trying to do is they're trying to take your good idea and make it a little bit better. And so I'm going to be very willing to support your bill, you know, after...
Noise level is rising again. Let's keep it down so the senators can hear.
After some of these changes occur, right? Because I'm convinced that you are a man that does not want to see the taxpayers be built any more than they already are.
Right. I do not, and that's not the intent of what I'm trying to do. Actually, I'm trying to give them more ability on the local level. Of course, I've got more confidence maybe in back home than assessors.
Yep.
And I'm not saying they're all the same. But I don't have a, you know, if that's what it is, if the amendments come out, they come out, you know. And I respect your opinion on that. My only thinking was, is could they possibly ever, if you took the low number, you know the business and I know it briefly, or a little bit about it, but do you put that in the hands of a tax commission? Do they understand that? And that was my only concern. And I don't know.
Right,
I mean, that's the unknown for me. If they only have one choice.
Yeah, I think that's a good and valid concern. At the same time, I think it kind of speaks to the point that I'm trying to make, and that is, you know, people, I think, can be good, right? But government rarely is. You've noticed that,
yeah.
Right? I mean, we've been around this building a long time.
People
can be good, but government rarely is. And when we leave the decision to government to decide how much money is going to be extracted from the people, I have this theory, I don't know if it's true, but I have a theory that says, you know, government has an insatiable desire for two things, your liberty and your money. And any time we create a situation that allows government to be the one, government to be the entity that decides how much money is going to be extracted from the people, I just have this theory that because government has an insatiable desire for more of your money and your liberty, that government will always migrate in the direction of and find a way to maximize how much money they take away from the people. And so I'm in agreement with the senator from Clay as far as we need to mandate to these governmental entities. I don't like micromanaging, but I do think we need to create restraints for government where we say they have to, whether it's on an annual basis, maybe each year they evaluate and say, okay, this year we're going to use such and such book because we've seen empirically that it is the lower of the books, or whether it's every other year or whatever. I just think that safeguard to the taxpayer, and keep in mind, we're not talking about what I believe to be a fair situation anyway.
It's kind of like we're coming in and saying, hey, we know that the mafia boss is coming in once a month and taking $1,000 from you so that you can own a business in his neighborhood. We know that's happening, and we don't have the power to stop that mafia boss from taking that money from you, but we're going to get it to where he takes a little bit less from you. That's kind of like all we can do.
We're on the motion of the Senator. Or is she, yes.
No, I said.
Senator from Polk.
Request that bill be laid over on the informal counter.
I have the floor.
But the bill can be laid on the formal calendar at any point in time. It will be laid on the informal calendar. Senator from the 23rd.
Thank you, Mr. President. We will stay on that calendar, Senate Bill 572.
Staying on the informal calendar, Senate Bills for Perfection, Senate Bill 572.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Senator from the 23rd.
Thank you, Mr. President. I ask that Senate Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 572 be brought before the body.
You've heard the motion of the Senator from the 23rd. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. Senator from the 23rd.
Thank you, Mr. President. I have a Senate substitute.
Would you please, whoops. Senator, I think we need to move for the adoption of the Senate Committee Substitute.
Thank you, Mr. President. I will move for the adoption of the Senate Committee Substitute, and I have a Senate Substitute.
Please send your Substitute forward.
Thank you, Mr. President. For the sake of the body, I had a new Substitute that was put on desk this morning. It is .10F.
It has been distributed. Are you asking for a waiver of the reading?
It has been distributed.
The reading will be waived. Senator from the 23rd, would you like to explain your substitute?
Yes, thank you, Mr. President. I think I did move for the adoption. This is a topic that we're all familiar with. I say that I'm not building on the work of the Senator from Lawrence last year, but I'm continuing the work of the Senator from Lawrence from last year on related to workers' compensation, and we're trying to fix a few problems with this legislation. Number one, we're trying to address the problem that we have with co-employee liability. We're currently, we have what's taking place in the workplace. Employees are suing other employees for workplace injuries, and of which, you know, they have no coverage. So it's just created this situation where workers' compensation is not the exclusive remedy, where you have the workers' compensation system and you have this individual liability that is taking place outside of the workers' compensation system. Also, we're fixing that where an employee commits an intentional act. That person will still be liable with passage of this legislation. So we've got language in here to clarify that. We are reaffirming that occupational disease is the exclusive remedy for the workers' compensation system. In 2005, the way we defined accident created this problem through court interpretation, and we're going back and we're fixing that problem from the 2005 legislation. The language on co-employee liability is the same language as that which was adopted in the conference committee report on Senate Bill 8 last year, save for one word, and that is to basically to make clear how the sentence reads. I mean, it's instead of an employee engaged in an affirmative negligent act with the purpose of causing or increasing the risk of injury takes out the word negligent act. So it would be, it reads in the substitute, except that an employee shall not be released from liability for injury or death if the employee engaged in an affirmative act with the purpose of causing or increasing the risk of injury. I don't believe this material changes the intent of the conference report from last year, but I'm happy to discuss that if anyone has a question about that language change from last year. and the substitute takes out the second injury fund discussion, which I believe needs to take place on the floor of this chamber. But I from discussions that I've had with senators, I don't believe there's consensus yet on do we want a second injury fund? You know, if we do, how do we want that to be structured? And then how do we take care of that backlog of judgments? I think we need to have that discussion on the floor, and I only think it complicates the passage of this bill. And I believe, you know, this body did its work last year, having a conference committee report on co-employee liability. Prior to that, the senator from Lawrence had a bill that had, that addressed all three subjects, and so I believe we were very responsible in how we worked last year. The other change, I guess two changes. One, raise the death benefit from $5,000 to $10,000. So that we have an amount of judgments that is suitable to take care of burial expenses. So we raise that on every case, every workers' compensation case where there's a death benefit, we raise that from $5,000 to $10,000. And then included in the substitute is language that was offered by the senator, that was adopted, offered by the senator from CAPE last year, which relates to cases of toxic exposure and subrogation rights. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. Otherwise, I would renew my motion.
The senator from the 23rd has moved for the adoption of Senate substitute for Senate committee substitute for Senate Bill 572. Does any senator wish to speak on that motion? Senator from the 11th, what purpose do you seek recognition?
May I inquire of the senator from 23rd?
Senator from 23rd, do you yield?
I do.
He yields, Senator. You may proceed.
Thank you, Senator. I heard your explanation, and if you could return to, you mentioned, I have a copy of the conference committee report from 11S that was the last day of last session, right?
Yes.
And I was just curious, you referred to that and said that the language was identical. Where,
I said save for one word.
Except for one word. And what was that on?
The
co-employee?
On co-employee. If you look at, except that an employee shall not be released from liability for injury or death if the employee engaged in an affirmative act with the purpose of causing or increasing the risk of injury. That is how the substitute reads.
Okay.
I believe the conference committee report had between the words affirmative and act, it added the word negligent. So an affirmative negligent act with the purpose of causing or increasing the risk of injury.
Okay. We've removed the second injury fund. We've removed the language dealing with incarcerated individuals.
Yeah, that's...
We've removed the language involving not authorized work to work legally in the United States. Okay, we're putting all of occupation, even the toxic, under comp, right?
Yeah, all of correct.
Okay. And that's different than the language of the conference report. I mean, you didn't say they were the same.
Well, the conference report last year, the second conference report, was just co-employee liability. That's what actually passed
right.
The Senate.
Okay. All right, and then...
But prior to 2005, all occupational disease was under workers' compensation.
Right. And then, let's see, I'm just trying to understand everything that's in here. Because I'm not blaming you, we just got this about an hour ago, I think, right?
No, well, the difference between this sub and the sub that I dropped yesterday is just taking out the two parts related to the incarcerated individuals and those working legally and in the United States.
Okay.
Those are the only two differences between the yesterday's sub and today's sub.
On what?
The upper gallery is reminded that there is no flash photography while we are in session. We'd ask you
yes.
To refrain, please. Senators, proceed.
Senator, the other thing I wanted to kind of go over so I understand, The toxic is now in calm, okay? Last year in this bill, I mean, with your bill, it puts it back in comp, right?
Right, along with the subrogation rights proposed by the senator from Cape, which I know that we discussed that on the floor. We actually adopted that language when the bill passed the Senate initially.
Right, I remember that, and that hasn't changed substantially from last year. That has not changed substantially from last year.
You'd have to ask the senator from Cape, but I don't believe that's the case.
Okay. Now let's go back to currently in the status quo. If somebody dies of mesothelioma, that tends to happen late in life, right? I mean, they tend to be diagnosed. And what happens now that that person's under comp?
Well, I don't think it. The only reason that person would be treated differently would be related to the subrogation rights. Where if that person, if there was a determination that that company, you know, purposefully, intentionally put that employee in a position where they contracted mesothelioma, that person received a court judgment. Right now, or under this language, the employer or the insurance company that paid maybe a workers' compensation claim for that individual would not be able to recover those workers' compensation costs.
Okay, but now those in the status quo, some of those go to civil court, right? And your bill puts all of that back under comp, right?
Only under the existing standards that are under workers' compensation related to death or accident. If an employer is, you know, negligent, if grossly negligent, or like I said, purposefully, knowingly putting their employee in that type of work condition where they are contracting that illness, disease, then that they still have the ability to go into civil court.
Okay.
And that's, you know, if someone dies at work, same situation.
Okay.
You know, through a single incident.
Okay. And then under comp, that is a calculation, is it not, of the two-thirds of the average state wage or their wage? Isn't that how that works?
Oh, on the death benefit?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, if someone dies in a work accident, yeah, they're dependent. They've received the death benefit. It's $5,000 now. We're trying to change it to $10,000 with this legislation. And then the dependent would receive basically lifetime benefit unless they, you know, situation where someone gets remarried.
Well, and the reason I bring up that I brought up mesothelioma in particular is the nature of that, you know, the choice under comp in a circumstance could be, you know, do I take that the last year of my life, or do I take that option and go to my family? See, the mesothelioma, as you know, putting it under comp creates sort of a problem, just given the nature of that disease, that it's a toxic disease, right?
Well, I mean, it's definitely different than if someone, you know, dies at work versus what you're having in
right.
That type of case. You maybe have a diagnosis that is, you know, could be 2 years, 5 years, you know, 10 years down the road where they're diagnosed with mesothelioma. So in that respect, it's certainly different. And then you have that person could live, you know, whatever the length of their life, whether it be 1 year, 5 years, and then, you know, how do you treat the dependent in that
okay.
situation?
All right. Thank you, Senator. I just wanted to inquire and go over some of the basic.
We're on the motion of the Senator from the 23rd. Does any other senator wish to speak on that motion? Senator from the 13th, what prompts you seek recognition?
To inquire.
From the Senator 23rd?
Yes.
Do you yield, Senator?
Yes, I do.
You yield, Senator, you may proceed.
Senator, I apologize. When I left, we were on the tax issue. This is the workers' comp issue
yes.
we're taking up?
Yes. And point 10F is the substitute.
Oh, not 9F?
Yeah, basically, the difference between 9 and 10 is that...
the incarceration part.
Yes, correct. And
okay.
The,
explain to me the subrogation issue at the last, the toxic exposure portion.
Okay, I'm pulling. If you go to page 11, line 2.
Okay, here now I have 10F.
See, where there is a finding that an occupational disease was caused by toxic exposure and the employee or dependents are compensated under this chapter, in no case shall the employer be subrogated to the rights of an employee or the dependents of an employee against such third person when the employer caused the occupational disease. So my understanding of that section is if they receive the dependent, the employee or the dependent of the employee receives a judgment, a civil judgment. Under current law, the insurer, either the employer or the insurer for the employer would be able to recover any workers' compensation costs from that judgment. This will eliminate that ability for that employer or the insurer.
Are we putting...
Insurer.
When it comes to occupational disease back into the work comp system?
I'm sorry?
We're putting the occupational disease back in.
We're going back to the law prior to 2005.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. President.
Senator from the 13th.
Can I inquire the senator from Cape?
Senator from Cape. Do you yield to the senator from the 13th?
I yield.
You yield, Senator. You may proceed.
And, Mr. President.
Senator?
I can't find the 10F copy. I have the 09F, so could I get a 10F? Okay, thank you. To inquire the senator from Cape.
Proceed.
I yield. Senator, you were, I don't want you to fall over. I do listen to your inquiries. And in committee, both last year and this year and on the floor, this issue was dealt with. And I guess the agreement last year dealt with the subrogation issue, and that's how it left the Senate.
On occupational disease. I'm
yes.
sorry, where were
yes.
we? Yes, yes.
Okay,
yes.
Can you kind of go through, have
yeah.
you read the substitute? Can you
right.
do your little
yeah, sure.
work comp 101?
Right. All right. As I see it, there are three issues revolving workers' compensation in the state of Missouri. And these are just my opinions. Some people think, hey, they're not a problem at all. But there's three issues. There was a case titled Hooker that dealt with co-employee liability. There were not appellate court cases, but circuit court cases where Judge Durker denied a motion to dismiss on the exclusive remedy of workers' compensation relative to occupational disease claims on the circuit court level that have raised an issue that many people want to address. So that's the occupational disease. I believe Judge Durker found proper legal logic in that nowhere in state statute under strict construction do we say that occupational disease is an accident, therefore availing itself of workers' compensation resolution as opposed to civil court resolution. And that's what Judge Durker found, and it freaked a lot of the business community out. So that's one issue. And then one issue that I think is increasingly complex, but also pretty simple on the moving parts to solve it is the second injury fund and what you're willing to do. So those are the three issues that are out there. As I understand 10F on what the senator from the 23rd has brought forward is he is dealing with co-employee liability and he's dealing with occupational disease. Two of the three issues that I just highlighted dealing with workers' compensation. My understanding on co-employee liability, and I want to inquire the senator from Lawrence about this, is that he's almost doing what we did last year, but I want to at some point I'm going to ask the senator from Lawrence what his opinions are by taking the word negligently out of the Senate substitute prior to the word affirmative.
Well, if you're going to do that inquiry, last year when you dealt with it, I learned a lot listening to the two of you discuss the issue. So
right.
On that issue, if I know you're going to do right. The inquiry, I'm going to
do that with him. And then that would take me to occupational disease. And if you want to just a rehash of occupational disease again, occupational disease can be everything from mesothelioma to carpal tunnel. Carpal tunnel is pretty easy. You do an ulnar nerve release, but it's still a repetitive injury. Mesothelioma, repetitive injury, ingesting of some kind of toxic element that is carcinogenic that deposits itself in the alveoli of the lungs. Your lungs cannot expel that. It begins to what's called purulize, and it builds up in asbestos, black lung, silica, and mesothelioma. Horrible way to die, but no good way to die, if you want my opinion on that.
No, actually, if you're on the 18th green of Pebble Beach and you're about 87 years old and you just fall over, that's not too bad. There's a difference there.
Yeah. It depends on if you made the putt or missed the putt.
No, the eagle, the chip.
I've made plenty of eagles in my life. I still wouldn't want to die.
I don't want to live forever.
Yeah. But occupational disease, to turn back to that, so we know how it is created. The whole thought process is in light of the 2005 changes and what I believe is a correct judicial interpretation on the trial level of the statute that we passed in 2005 by not including occupational disease and accident, how do we then change the statutes to fold that in? One real easy way is to just say accident shall include occupational disease. But for me, I have seen real-world examples, particularly in the occupational disease area, and this is where the senator from St. Francis and I, who represent these individuals through a company called Gilster Mary Lee that was in southeast Missouri, we really didn't like what happened there relative to employees that got occupational disease, and we had some concerns. Through the give and take of the legislative process, the resolution that I offered on the Senate floor that was adopted by the Senate is to say simply this: fold occupational disease back into an accident, thereby allowing workers' compensation to deal with all of those as it relates to the employer. This only relates to the employer and the employer's negligence in workers' compensation. As a compromise, what was very offensive, and I don't mean to speak for the senator from St. Francis, but I believe what was very offensive to us was a particular case where an employer had individuals that received a toxic exposure, ultimate death, through working for this employer. They were paid in workers' compensation. Later, those families brought an independent third-party suit against a whole variety of other vendors that were not that individual's employer. They received a settlement in some cases and a jury verdict in other cases. And then this very employer, because of what's called subrogation, then went back and said, you know what, I paid $100,000, $150,000 for your workers' compensation injuries. I have subrogation rights the right to get the first 100, 150,000 after those damages that were there. And my belief is that would be an affront to any incentive where the employer would want to change in any way, shape, or form the way he or she or it provides an industrial hygiene program or overall worker safety programs or things along that, because clearly, I think possibly, an employer could sit back and say, you know what, I'm going to burn through my employees on workers' compensation. Hopefully they'll bring a third-party suit. I'll get all the money back I spent on workers' compensation, and I'm keeping my work environment the substandard level that it is, and it doesn't cost me anything.
So the civil proceedings can still take effect, not against the employer, but against the product, the
Correct.
Manufacturer of the product. So in your case, the manufacturer of the butter, but the popcorn manufacturer would only be liable in the work comp system.
Correct. So in my specific example, Gilster Mary Lee pays the workers' compensation, but if a third-party suit came against the respirator company, the popcorn flavoring company, the conveyor belt company, the air conditioning company, the filter company, the mask company, what usually happens in these settings?
Three senators on the floor. Senator from Phelps, what purpose do you seek recognition?
Mr. President, introduce very special guest. Unanimous consent.
Hearing no objection, Senator, proceed.
Mr. President, on my right and on your left in side gallery is Mr. and Mrs. John and Carolyn Taylor. They're retired teachers from Crawford County, and we'd like to thank them for their service.
Would the guests of the Senator from Phelps please rise and the body make them feel welcome. Proceed, Senators.
Thanks. And I said what usually happens in these cases is all of those lists of individuals end up getting sued civilly. The employer is then dismissed because workers' compensation is the exclusive remedy, and either the case goes to trial or it settles. A lot of the issues that are in play in the third-party suit is whether or not the respirators did the function that they thought they would do. For instance, with popcorn flavoring, you're supposed to have a rating 6 filter. That means it's a closed system. Not just a 3M paper mask, if you're familiar with what I'm talking about, and sometimes the utilization of those in those environments becomes an issue, and ultimately those lawsuits are resolved outside of workers' compensation.
In my youthful days, I was a construction worker, so I was around those masks that you discussed, so yes, I do know what you're discussing.
Sure.
Let's change, because I'm going to allow you to inquire of the senator from Lawrence, but before we go down that path, let's go into the second injury fund issue.
Okay.
That's totally off the table.
Right. Well, not just in this bill. It's not addressed in this bill. I don't think it's off the table. I think it needs to be addressed. I think
everybody agrees it needs to be addressed on both sides, because I concur with the issue on the second injury fund. That I don't think my daughter, who has began her work career last year, her taxes should have to pay second injury fund cases eventually. So with the state and the obligation of the state, we don't know where that lies. I concur with you. I don't think the future generation should take that responsibility. The handler of the bill said, I guess the plan is taking that up separately.
Yes.
Than to dealing with this issue.
Correct.
As well.
Correct.
Instead of dealing with all of them as one, because I do read the chamber's little weekly rag, I guess you could call it.
Yeah, and I don't read that, nor do I read the UAW's deal or Labor Times.
I don't read the UAW's either.
Unless I see your picture on them, Senator. Then I read those articles. Just like the senator from Jefferson made front page last week, I read that article.
I'm trying to relinquish the baton of the front page.
I don't think I've ever made the front page on any of them, at least not in a flattering way.
You've made front page here or there, I'll give you that.
Just not in a flattering way.
In their weekly, there was a recent ruling on the second injury fund at the circuit court level. Can you explain that to me?
I haven't read the actual opinion, but my understanding of it is they think that that is going to escalate or heighten the fact that we need to deal with a resolution to the second injury fund. But I haven't actually gotten the trial court level's interpretation and rulings. Of course, that's going to be appealed, as all of them are appealed, so I haven't invested a whole lot of time until we actually see the appellate decision that'll actually flow from that. But I understand it. There's really three lawsuits that are matriculating through the civil courts dealing with the second injury fund, and I think one of two things is going to happen ultimately with it. Either the taxpayers are going to get dinged for the unfunded liability that's associated there, and it's going to be a massive judgment, or they're going to say that the 3% cap that we put 3% of workers' compensation premiums that funds the second injury fund is a foul, and they're going to raise that to cover, and it's going to be a massive assessment on all the employers at that point. So when I said second injury fund is a complicated issue, but relatively simple, because there's not a whole lot of moving parts to the second injury fund. Now, a lot of people want to make that there's a whole lot of moving parts, but there really isn't. We owe all of these people this money. Without question, we owe it. And the decision is, how are you going to get the money, and what system are you going to leave in the future? I think those are the challenges that face us on the second.
I think the challenges we face is we have two competing chambers in the state of Missouri that if one takes a step and says we have to go this direction, the other says we have to go this direction, so they can continue to compete with the business community instead of dealing with the issue. That's how I see the game being played.
I view, and I hope the Senate, just to be clear, I hope the Senate has learned some lessons from when the Senate dealt with the employee discrimination deal and doing what these special interest groups want us to do, and then relatively what we find out they tell the other end of the building we need to do. And hopefully senators will be able to start sitting down and say, you know what, I hear you, I appreciate your philosophy, but last time I checked, you don't get a vote here, and I'm going to take the information that you have, and we're going to forge what we think is a proper solution relative or alternatively to just doing whatever these special interest organizations say we need to do when they have really no logic behind it other than what I believe cynically. They don't want to fix this stuff. The moment they fix this stuff, Senator, there's no longer a reason to join their organization. They no longer have a membership drive alert. It's like Missouri Right to Life. Missouri Right to Life so desperately wants to find meaning to themselves that they rate Joan Bray more pro-life than me. It's crazy. Except for repealing Roe v. Wade that we can't do in the state of Missouri, I don't know that we can be any more pro-life. But that organization still wants to have its members and still want to do everything else. That what I have seen is a lot of those organizations, they don't want to fix anything. They don't really want to cure anything. They just want to have the issues so that they can go out and do membership drives with it. I mean, that's what I found clearly. All of these organizations, in my discussions with the handler of the bill, all of these organizations said what I was doing with occupational disease was horrible. We can't stand it. It's not going to work. That's what all the organization representatives said. So then I brought all the big companies in, and I said, this is what I'm doing. Why do you have a problem with it? Oh, we don't. We don't. We don't. And then you go back to these organizations and you say, who has a problem with what we're doing? Well, just members. Which ones? Well, just members. It's insane that we allow these special interests that much decision-making prowess over this body. Because we have seen with what these organizations did on the employment discrimination bill, and what they've done and was exposed in our discussions on workers' compensation, you know, it's our fault. It's our fault that we don't peel the layers of the onion back and actually get to the root cause of everything, which I think these organizations don't want to fix anything. They create these straw men and women, stand them up, and use them as platforms in which to get members to their organizations.
Not veering off our discussion, but with that discrimination bill, I started receiving calls yesterday from two of my municipalities. There's question we've done something with their sovereign immunity in that discrimination bill. I don't know if any of your municipalities have contacted you, but that just hit my phone messaging yesterday, and the Muni League's up here. I have to go out with some of them tonight, so I'm sure I'll get more of a clarification on some of the issues that we opened up with that discrimination bill, which was voted on last week. But here nor there, that's a different issue. The reasoning, and I guess that question would be better off to the chairman, for splitting the second injury fund, dealing with the occupational disease, and dealing with the co-employee liability, it's just fit to separate them at this time? Or would, I guess, that be more of a fair question to the senator from the 23rd?
Well, I think the whole idea is we have no idea where the governor is on any of this stuff, okay? And whether he wants to be governor or he doesn't want to be governor, he does have, based upon our form of government, some say in this.
Right.
And I know the senator from the 23rd, myself, have been trying to say, what does the governor think? What will the governor sign? What will he advocate for? And, you know, all I can conclude is he wants to be governor, to go fly around and do virtual press releases on jobs. But when it comes down to actually the big issues of the day, or at least impacting legislation and having a dialogue, I believe there's a separation of powers, but I would hope that what we try to do is take these issues, reduce them down to what's already passed the Senate before, and try to get those to the second floor. And because the governor doesn't want to engage in the process, at least we'll have either a signed bill or a veto message that we can deal with accordingly. The logic that I take is, you know, we had to do that with the puppy mills fix that we did last year, and we had to do that with the senator from Nottoway's permitting bill. And it seems the only way you're really going to get any information out of the second floor on what he may or may not sign is to send something to him to get a veto message. That's the only way I know how to communicate with this guy.
I think going on the second injury fund, if you recall last year, and I think sometimes people don't realize that we all do sit in a room and try to resolve things, but I think we can attest that you were in that room. The senator from the 11th and myself were in the room, and we all agreed, no matter what side of the issue you are on, we need to do something about the second injury fund. We had a tentative agreement for a while. It was moving in the House, and I think at the last day of session last year, we had an agreement on second injury, how to deal with it in co-employee liability, and left the third one off that I think we could all agree on in the chamber at that time, said no, we want the occupational disease issue is more important, so let's just let the bill die and we'll come back next year, because I think the premises is their top priority is the occupational disease.
Yeah, some people give those organizations credence. You know, I just don't. I don't even know what happened last year. You know, I mean, it was, you're a legislator, and as a legislator, you have the ability to give some other entity your vote, and instead of using your own mind and logic. And I think at the end of last session, particularly in the House, there were those individuals that chose to rip their own brain and thought process out and just do whatever these special interest organizations told them to do, whether it made sense or it didn't make sense.
I'm not finished on the inquiries, but I wanted to bring the issue up to make sure that you and the senator from Lawrence were going to explore this issue, because I was on the conference committee last year. I listened throughout that process. I listened throughout this. We're taking second injury fund out. The senator from the 23rd says we're going to probably do that separate. I guess I'll go back to being a student of Occupational Disease 101 and see where we're going and how I'm going to decide on how I'm going to play on this issue.
Sounds good. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Senator from Kate.
If I could inquire the senator from Lawrence.
Senator from Lawrence, do you yield to the senator from Kate?
I yield.
He yields. Senator, you may proceed.
Thank you for yielding, Senator, and I appreciate last year all your work on this effort, and this bill went through the Judiciary Committee and did not go that direction this year. But I do appreciate the senator from the 23rd, I think, visited with you. I know that he's visited with me, and I think we're getting closer to a bill that we worked on last year relative to the two issues of co-employee liability and occupational disease, framed in a way that may find passage in this Senate. I see that the senator from the 11th has dropped a new amendment dealing with occupational disease that's bringing a new item or issue forward. We'll have to see how the body wants to resolve that. But my direct questions, because I know you dealt with this last year and looked at it very much, including all the case law that was associated with it. How do you feel about the language spelled out in Senate Substitute 10F relative to co-employee liability and dealing with the Hooker case?
I think it gets us close. Right. What I want to see, and what I've really understood the goal of those interested in this issue to be, is getting us where the case law would have had us if we had not really omitted the co-employee language when we put strict construction into the 2005 statute.
Right.
I don't think the 10F gets us precisely there. I've been visiting this morning with the senator from the 23rd about how I think we get precisely there. And, you know, it's a technical body of law. And when you look at the something more test that is a part of the co-employee liability analysis, even the courts applying that standard have recognized that it's fairly amorphous. I mean, it's hard to nail down exactly what that something more is. And I think that as we reached the conference committee report, the last one, last
on session, 8, yeah.
Right.
Senate Bill 8 last year.
There was sort of an evolution of language that resulted in some change in the standard, and that evolution did start with some case law. There was the Taylor decision, which articulated really what something more was to that point. Robinson versus Hooker referred to Taylor, but they, I think, trying to make a prettier sentence, rearranged some words, which potentially has the impact of changing the standard. Subsequently, there's been the Burns versus Smith decision, which I think is a pretty clear articulation of what something more is in Missouri. And Judge Limbaugh wrote the decision. So I've been talking to the senator from the 23rd about letting that be a clear statement of what something more is in statute. Again, as I've talked to the senator from the 23rd, he's been assuring that his desire is to get us to where we would have been had we not had the legislative oversight by failing to include co-employees in 2005. And I believe that this language gets us there if we can make that slight variation in the substitute.
Is in that slight variation, if you look at page 4, line 8, is that inserting the word negligent after affirmative?
It's a little more than that. Let me get to line 8. I'll read you what the case
said. Okay, so you have an amendment to deal with that, because my only point is I understand you know, the co-employee liability. I want to be supportive of that change. I want to address Robinson versus Hooker, and I just don't want to do any more than that.
Right.
You know, I mean, we had long debates in 2005 about the something more doctrine. And just once again, for the benefit of the body, the something more doctrine is similar to this. I'm working with a co-employee in a job site, and for the benefit of the senator from the 13th, I'll make it an electrical example. My co-employee says, stick your hand in that transfer box. I turned off the power. And I'm like, are you sure? Stick your hand in that electrical box. I turned off the power, or I'm going to fire you, or I'm going to write you up, or I'm going to turn you in. You walk over there, you stick your hand in the electrical box, and you get electrocuted. That is something more than ordinary workers' compensation negligence. So where the law has been within workers' compensation is to say that in that particular set of circumstances, very narrow set of circumstances, when it is something more than ordinary worker environment harm that comes to you, you will have redress in the civil courts for that. And when we dealt with this in 2005, many people of these organizations that wanted these changes said, oh, we need to get rid of the something more doctrine, you know. I should be able to tell you to do anything, and if it's in the line of your work, then it's covered by workers' compensation. Well, no. You know, and I think it's very logical at that point to preserve the something more doctrine. But I also think it's very logical, as you have tried to do, to say, you know what, co-employees should be treated as employers within the workers' compensation structure.
I am very committed to fixing the Robinson versus Hooker problem, which, I mean, we call it that as if it's a judicially created problem. That was a case that identified a legislatively created problem,
right,
in my opinion. So I want to make that clear, that we are here to correct an oversight on our part several years ago. But I think we absolutely have to fix it. I don't think co-employees should be hanging out there for liability for these kinds of situations. But my interest, and what I've understood to be the interest of our colleagues, is to get us where we would have been had that legislative accident not occurred. And I believe that this Burns decision does it. And what it says is that something more that is required can be best described as an affirmative act that creates additional danger beyond that normally faced in the job-specific work environment. It's the clearest articulation of what's been a something more test for a long time. And I think our jobs as legislators and policymakers is to look at any change to the law that we are about to make, trying to anticipate every situation that we can come up with that's going to affect every Missourian that has entrusted us to come out here and put the reflection of their shared values into our law books. And I think there are those situations. I think far and away, in almost all cases, there should not be co-employee liability. But when you've got the situation where there was, you know, the serious situation where that employee, through this something more, put another in danger, it's a different situation, and that door should not be closed entirely. That's worked well before. In 2005, we made the conscious decision as a legislature, right, not to abrogate something more. It was an accident that we did this. So I just, right, want to get us to the same yard line we'd have been on had we not made that mistake in the first place.
So do you have an amendment, or do you plan to offer an amendment that'll in put in place the Burns decision language? And
My hope is whether we see it through a new substitute or an amendment, that, okay, this is the language that we ultimately are voting on. And I've had some conversations with the senator from the 23rd today. As far as timing and how things go on the floor, I don't know which way we go. But I think that's the best way to accomplish the goal in fairness to all Missourians.
Okay. And I agree with you. I think we need to work through the senator from the 11th Amendment. It's another way in which to deal with the occupational disease side. I look forward to hearing his pitch for his amendment and see where we're at. And I don't know if there's any other issues that'll pop up out there, but I appreciate the dialogue on co-employee liability, and I'm supportive of your efforts on that front for whatever it's worth. I often tell people I'm either with you or against you, whatever helps you the most.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. President.
We're on the motion of the Senator from the 23rd. Senator from the 11th, what purpose do you seek recognition?
I have an amendment.
Send your amendment forward. Has it been distributed?
It has, Mr. President. I would ask for a waiver of the reading.
Hearing no objection, the reading will be waived. Senator, would you like to explain your amendment?
Mr. President, I move for the adoption of the amendment. We dealt a little bit with this issue last year, and mesothelioma and some of the toxic occupational diseases involved in this bill are unique in that often they're not diagnosed until far too late or late in life or when somebody's in their 60s or in there. The bill in front of us, upon death, under current law, an employee's benefit, this is a death benefit that we're raising from $5,000 to $10,000. This amendment would allow an injured worker by toxic exposure to bring a total claim and also to his dependents bring a death claim benefit. The employee's dependents would receive 3 years of compensation at 210% of the state weekly wage, with the current stage average weekly wage, I calculate, by this calculation, it would be about $253,000 upon death. This tries to respond to the circumstance unique to toxic diseases and occupational diseases in that the family and the person who receives it, under the Senator from 23rd's bill, would be left with essentially a $10,000 burial fee. I don't know that it's perfect. I certainly would like the Senator from Cape and Lawrence to think about it. I will tell you in all candor, the other reason I'm offering this amendment, I did not want to leave this bill open so it could be closed upon. And I'm not saying that that would happen, but I like to do that. It might be an imperfect amendment, but I want, as the Senator from Cape and Lawrence just discussed, and the Senator from Third did last year in this discussion, we as a body have to deal with this issue of, are we cutting off some worker by creating such a high standard, which the business community wants an incredibly high standard of negligence in all of these cases, to where we are leaving somebody who dies of mesothelioma and their families with a $10,000 burial fee. I found in committee, Mr. President, the most compelling discussion between the Senator from Cape and a lawyer who handles these cases. And in that circumstance, there was somebody who produced a toxic material. The neighborhood that lived next door could sue them in civil court for damages. The worker who was involved in that production could not and would be stuck under comp. And if it was mesothelioma or a toxic disease in that matter, they would be precluded from pursuing civil court. Whether this is the right way to go about it, it is an issue that's out there that makes me totally uncomfortable with this bill to deny and cut off someone the ability or their dependents and survivors from pursuing remedy. And with that, Mr. President, I'll be happy to yield to any questions.
Senator from the 11th has moved for the adoption of Senate Amendment Number 1. Does any senator wish to speak on that motion?
Mr. President.
Senator from the 11th.
May I inquire of Senator from Lawrence?
Senator from Lawrence, do you yield to Senator from the 11th?
I yield.
You yield, Senator, you may proceed.
Senator, you heard my explanation. I don't know. I think that this is a variation of what the Senator from Cape did last year. His was, I think, a different calculation, but conceptually about the same. Am I right that in the current bill, somebody with mesothelioma, unless you prove that there was, that the employer intentionally, knowingly did that, that that would leave that survivor and their families essentially with a death benefit? Am I reading that correctly?
Well, I believe that there would be situations, depending on who the survivors and dependents of the claimant were, that could certainly be the case. Those scenarios could occur.
Now, isn't one of the problems from that in the underlying bill, we're creating such a difficulty of proving that against the employer, or we're creating a higher threshold, are we not?
There is, let me pull my bill up so I make sure I'm familiar with the version we got this morning. Yeah, the language appears fairly clear in regard to the employer that this is to be the exclusive remedy. Obviously, if you show intent, presumably you go out to the civil litigation. But if you've got someone who dies, or they've got the latency period, suddenly they're diagnosed, they die fairly quickly, leaving no dependents, they could just get the death benefit.
Right. Under the without this amendment, there could be a circumstance where they would get $10,000 and that would be it. And am I correct that mesothelioma, some of the popcorn, that a lot of those diseases don't develop until they're in their 60s or 70s, right?
A lot of times there's a long latency period. I mean, and we're assuming someone dies quickly enough that there aren't medicals and those kinds of things for this hypothetical, but...
So under the comp system, right now in civil court, in theory, their remedy could transcend their lifespan, right? Of that it could provide a benefit for their dependents. But put one of the disadvantages of putting them under comp is they would get, what, about a year or two-thirds of their salary? Is that right?
Depending on the duration of their illness.
Okay. Thank you, Senator. Mr. President?
Senator, the 11th.
Could I inquire a senator from Cape?
Senator from Cape, do you yield?
I yield.
He yields, Senator. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senator, I appreciate you yielding.
Yeah.
I think you heard my explanation. I remember some of what you did last year, and I guess that's kind of you and I and the senator from 23rd met last week about this.
Right.
And I just found that to be the most compelling, and this is maybe my attempt to deal with one of the issues, right. And I don't know if I'm batting 200 or batting 500 or batting.
Well, I think you're 84. Doing. I think you're doing what you think is right, and in your mind, in the way I read this opinion, in my opinion, or this amendment, in my opinion, is that you believe mesothelioma and the type of occupational disease that comes from toxic exposure deserves a benefit enhancement. And what your amendment will do in all practical effects it will say, notwithstanding any other provision of the law, if you have this type of toxic exposure ailment and either you're alive or you die from it, your, as a person or your estate, your heirs, will have a claim to get this increased benefit. And
do you remember, Senator, do you remember what was your formulation last year? Did you not have a hybrid of this?
I don't remember. I know it was rejected, and that's why I ultimately settled on the subrogation issue. I don't know where the body is going to be, and I don't recall exactly what my First Amendment was, and you may have that. I probably put it at a higher percentage than what you're going with now, thinking that would leave me room to negotiate. That's my typical MO.
Right.
But I don't remember as I stand here in this inquiry the exact numbers or calculations that I proposed. But this was similar to what I had offered early in the debate. It was rejected, and then I fell back to the subrogation issue, which was ultimately accepted. That's the progression.
And the language in 10F on subrogation, is that?
That is the language that the Senate ultimately abided by and passed out of here. It is also what the conference committee agreed to, and we just couldn't get the House to take up the conference committee report.
You know, we all signed it, but then the House said, we're not taking it up now. And just so you know where you are, you know, last year I supported all of this, and I went, and it was rejected. I have had discussions with the senator from the 23rd, and where I feel I'm compelled at, I told the senator from the 23rd that I would be for reopening all of occupational disease in dealing with that again, or I would appreciate it if the senator from the 23rd incorporated where the Senate found itself last session. So I feel personally bound by my word that I've given the senator from the 23rd to vote against your amendment, because he has now included the language that passed the Senate and ultimately got into the conference committee report the first time. So where I'm going to shake out, for whatever it's worth, is I'm going to keep my word to the senator from the 23rd that if he put in basically the subrogation issues with occupational disease, that that would placate me, and I would support that position, and I would appreciate that position. Now, I don't know if he is supportive of this or not, but I feel I'm bound, even though I supported this in a way of a discussion last year, I feel more bound to where we resolved ourselves as a Senate and what got out, and to keep my word to that.
No, you're right. This did not prevail last year. Okay.
Yeah. So that, I will vote, at one time I supported what you were doing.
Right.
And because I do believe that toxic exposure occupational disease is entirely different than occupational disease of a carpal tunnel or, you know, any kind of other repetitive injury or degenerative disc or anything else like that that may be in there. But I feel bound in the negotiations.
No, I understand
process of the Senate to stick to what I told the senator from the 23rd I would do.
And I just wanted to get your perspective, because I think you have a good
Absolutely. I tried to get the Senate to adopt this last year. Let me rephrase. Similar to this, I probably had higher values than you, if I had to guess.
Right. You did. I think it was yours. I think calculation was like 1.4 million or 1.3 million or something like that.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it was.
Okay.
It was probably.
I appreciate the inquiry, Senator.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
We're on the motion of the Senator from the 11th. Does any other Senator wish to speak on that motion? Senator from the 23rd.
I ask that bill be placed on the informal calendar.
It will be laid on an informal calendar with the amendment pending. Senator from the 23rd.
Mr. President, without objection, the Senate will go to the order of business of announcements.
On the order of business of announcements, Senator from the 13th.
Yes, Mr. President, announcement. The Missouri Retired Teachers Association has a reception in the rotunda, and they want to make sure all the Senate and their staffs were invited.
On the order of business of announcements, Senator from 23rd.
Thank you, Mr. President. No further business coming before the body. I move the Senate stand adjourned under the rules.
Heard the motion of the Senator from the 23rd. All in favor of that motion say aye. Opposed, no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. The Senate will stand adjourned under the rules.